It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The University of Pittsburgh volleyball team wraps up another extremely successful regular season tomorrow evening at home against Louisville. But the number two nationally ranked squad has already clinched a third straight ACC championship and has earned an automatic bid to the NCAA tournament. Joining us in studio are two of its top players, senior Stephanie Williams from Eastlake, Ohio, and Lane Van Buskirk from Windsor, Ontario, as well as head coach Dan Fisher. Welcome to the Confluence.
Thank you. Thank you.
It's good to be here.
So I've heard the games lately have been packing the Fitzgerald Fieldhouse where you usually play your games on campus. Stephanie, Coach Fisher tells me it's been pretty raucous. Would you agree?
Yeah, I think it's pretty exciting in there. We've had a very consistent crowd lately, and especially like against our Georgia Tech game, it was really loud in there. We really felt the support, and I think it helped us get a few extra points.
Are you feeling the student body support, Lane?
Yeah, I for sure love the Fieldhouse. Like, we can feel that thing, so it's pretty awesome to have a full crowd and super loud in there.
Are you getting the support from the school? I mean, you have a major university with lots of team sports. Are you feeling that support from the other athletes, from the student body as a whole, Coach?
We're definitely feeling the support, you know, and of course we want even more. You know, we want to blow this thing up, and you know, our administration has bought us a new floor. That we have brand new LED boards, so there's been an investment. The band is at every game. We have a great college atmosphere.
To Lane and Stephanie, I'd like, what's been the highlight so far of your senior seasons? Lane, we'll start with you.
The highlight for me and probably as a team was taking down Penn State in our preseason, because they were just like, we lost to them our last 2 years in the tournament, so like getting revenge and sweeping them was amazing.
Mm-hmm. All right. A little revenge. What about you, Stephanie?
All right. That was my same answer, but I also think clinching the title for the third straight year, it wasn't our like high school of the year, but it's definitely a good stepping stone to that point, and it really just shows like our focus and just will to like keep repeating, because it's not easy to like win so many back-to-back, so I think it's been winning at Duke is pretty cool. Plus, we haven't won there since 2014, so that was a nice, solid win for the program as well.
Right. Well, Coach, how competitive is the ACC in volleyball?
It's probably the third or fourth toughest conference this year, and I think we'll get four or five teams in the tournament. And I think in the next couple of years, it's going to get even tougher. So we're well prepared going into the tournament, and I think the girls are really just chomping at the bit to actually be there. So,
and we'll find out December 1st not only what your seed is, but how many ACC teams will be included in the 64-team field, right?
That's exactly right.
All right. Dan, I wanted to ask you, your team members come from all over the globe, really. When you are recruiting, first of all, where do you look? And then what are you looking for in the individual athlete?
Well, we always start locally and, then just go from there. And, you know, volleyball is one of the biggest sports in the world. And so we have some girls from overseas. We have some girls from the West Coast. And, you know, we look for the whole package. If we can't get everything we want, we definitely have made it a priority to recruit arms. And so we have some pretty powerful attackers on our team.
Okay. Well, let's talk a little bit more about the skill sets.
Yeah.
How do you recruit so that they complement each other, so that the whole team is that full package that you want?
Well, yeah, we have to recruit, you know, certain positions. We have to have a setter that's good, and we have to have a back row player that's good. But one of the things that's different about us is we really train the whole game. And so, we have – a lot of girls on our team that could play multiple positions. So we focus less on just getting pieces and more about just training the whole game.
Lane, you're from Windsor, Ontario, correct?
I am.
All right. And Stephanie, you're from Eastlake, Ohio.
Yes.
What made you want to come to Pitt? Lane, first you.
Yeah, Pitt was the first like Power 5 conference school to reach out to me and recruit me. But as Fish was saying, I think that it's also pretty evident that they recruit like good people and we have a really strong team culture, and that's super important. So that was pretty important for me coming to a school, and it's also somewhat close to home, so my parents can come up and visit me.
And do they come and see you play as well?
Every weekend.
Every weekend.
I'll jump in. Your Lane was a top 10 tennis player in Canada, and I had to convince her she was a volleyball player.
All right, yeah. So were you being recruited for collegiate tennis as well?
Yeah, I always planned on going to play somewhere warm tennis, and it really flipped on me.
Stephanie, so why Pitt for you?
Yeah, I'm from Cleveland area, so it only was like 2 hours from home. My family can come visit, and very strong academics. I thought the move from the Big East to ACC was definitely could really show how far I can grow as a player. And I really just loved like the coaching staff and the girls. I really felt just like home when I arrived on campus.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Our guests are with the number 2 ranked Pitt volleyball team. The squad has already clinched a 3rd straight ACC championship and an automatic bid to the NCAA tournament. Lane, how's the vibe in the gym changed over the years? You're racking up win after win. More people there? More support?
For sure. Like my freshman year, it was pretty much just like our parents and a couple friends and family. But it's now like the whole Pittsburgh community is getting behind us, and it's so much fun to play there.
Stephanie, have you noticed an increase in energy?
Exponentially. As Lane said, it was like 30 people in the stands, and now it's like almost consistently 1,000 at the Fieldhouse. So it's definitely been cool to watch the growth over the years. As we've grown as a team, the community also is just getting more excited as we are.
You find out Sunday your NCAA tournament seed and your first round opponent. Anyone you're hoping to face or hoping not to face first thing? Go ahead, Lane.
Last year we lost to Michigan, and I would like to get revenge on them now, too.
That was in round 2?
Correct.
Okay. All right. So you want revenge against Michigan.
Yes.
Stephanie?
I agree with Lane. I think that they might send us another Big Ten school, and I think Michigan would be very satisfactory. Ever since I've been here, obviously Michigan's been a very well-coached team. They've always been the top 25, and I think last year we really had an opportunity to beat them and really go further in the tournament than we have, and we kind of blew it. And I would really like revenge on that and just to like play a really complete game and have our home crowd really support us.
All right, Coach Fish, are we going to get coach speak here? Are we going to get an answer? Who would you like to? Who would you maybe not like?
Yeah,
to
yeah, I'll give you a little bit of coach speak. There's no one we don't want to play. I'll put it this way. I'd rather play some teams later on in the tournament than early.
Is there a style that you match up better with, a style of play, would you say?
Good question. I think we're pretty good with multiple styles at this point. You know, when you get deep in the tournament, it's every team's good. You know, the strength of our team is that we're balanced and we don't have to rely on one player. There's a few teams that have individual players that are so dominant that are pretty scary to go up against. So I think that's maybe I'd answer that way. There's a few teams that have just one player that is so hard to stop that it's that you kind of have this feeling of, man, if they're really going off, what are we going
to
do?
Anybody you'd like to name?
Well, I think Stanford has one. I think, Cincinnati, who we beat earlier in the year, has arguably the best player in college, and we could possibly see them. Penn State has a middle that is a load to deal with. So I think there's a few that come to mind.
Okay. So 3 straight conference titles, 3 years getting, I believe, knocked out in the second round. Lane, it's your last chance as seniors to help get the team over the hurdle. What's it going to take to break that little mini trend there?
I think we just have to keep on the road that we're on, practicing really hard and scouting really hard, just preparing to do everything we can to be our best come game day.
Mm-hmm. Stephanie, what's it going to take?
Yeah, I think it's going to take not taking the little things for granted, like our pregame routine, all of our practicing, like what we're eating, what we're sleeping, how we're training. I think all those things really matter and like come to the forefront like when it's game time. And you just have to, like, when you're in the moment, you just have to really trust your skills and kind of just go for it and trust your teammates that they have your back and that we've put in the work scouting-wise and just to, like, really have fun out there and, like, be in the moment and also just play really hard with no regrets.
You have each won individual honors, All-American honorable mention. What will a deep run in the tourney by the team mean to you in addition to your individual honors?
I think it means way more to me than any of the individual honors I've ever gotten. Of course, they're nice at the end of the season to be like, okay, yeah, I had a pretty good year. It's cool to rack up these accolades. But, I mean, we're a team sport for a reason, and we call each other sisters, and I truly believe that. Like, we care so much about our, like, main staff as the coaches, all of our support staff, and getting past the second round is something that I've dreamed about ever since coming here, and we've been unsuccessful. But I think we really have a chance to do it this year, and I'm really excited for the opportunity.
Coach, is it especially exciting because of where the Final Four will be?
Yeah, no question. I mean, we kind of had a meeting in January of last year, and we knew we had the core of the team back, and I just made the announcement. I said, hey, guys, what do you think my goal is next year? What do you think I'm pushing you for? And a couple of people said, well, maybe a Sweet 16, Elite Eight. I said, no, what do you think the Final Four is? I want to be there. Like, whether we're good enough or not, time will tell, but hey, like, let's just say it out loud. We all want to be there. And so the heads were nodding, and so that's kind of the last we really talked specifically about our goal as a team. It was like, hey, yeah, we know where the Final Four is this year.
And it's in Pittsburgh.
That's exactly right.
All right. Stephanie Williams and Lane Van Buskirk are seniors on the Pitt volleyball team, which has won the ACC championship for a third straight year. They're headed next to the NCAA tournament. Dan Fisher is their coach. Congratulations. Good luck on the court.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Kylie Kaczynski, still ahead on The Confluence. A conversation with a state lawmaker trying to reform Pennsylvania's criminal justice system. Plus, a miniature model of Western Pennsylvania has been drawing people from the region to get into the holiday spirit for 100 years. We'll talk with the curator of the Carnegie Science Center's Miniature Railroad and Village display. And just ahead, thousands of runners are gearing up for a race to ease food insecurity in Pittsburgh. Find conversations, stories, and more from this and past episodes of the show on our website at wesa.fm/confluence. The Confluence continues next on 90.5 WESA.
When it comes to holiday-inspired music, of course Christmas is king. Now, there certainly are a wealth of songs out there about being thankful, but there are significantly fewer about the holiday specifically. There's the very juvenile Thanksgiving song from Adam Sandler.
I eat that turkey, then I take...
Or the more poignant Dylan-esque Thanksgiving Day Parade by Dan Byrne. The most memorable of all might be the one without any words. The Vince Guaraldi Trio recorded music for 17 Peanuts specials. A Charlie Brown Thanksgiving first aired 46 years ago this week. For 91.3 WYEP, I'm Joey Spehar.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Thousands of runners will take part Thursday morning in the annual YMCA Turkey Trot. But no matter who crosses the finish line first in the various races, the real winners will be our Pittsburgh neighbors who are struggling with food insecurity. Carolyn Grady is the Senior Vice President of Development for the YMCA of Greater Pittsburgh. Carolyn, good morning.
Good morning, Kevin.
During the holiday season, food is often on our minds, a favorite, a traditional dish. But getting enough food is on the minds of many of our Pittsburgh neighbors every day, isn't it?
Sadly, that is very true.
So how can a foot race help end hunger, or at least ease it?
So the YMCA Turkey Trot is our annual, it's our largest fundraiser at the YMCA of Greater Pittsburgh, and the mission is really to raise awareness and raise funds for the Y's many food insecurity initiatives. For example, we house 170 men on the north side and in the Hill District, and we run a congregate dining program in Hazelwood throughout the year. We do weekend backpack programs for children in need. And also we run emergency food pantries, and we participate with a food bank and run a food bank distribution program.
So it's not just monetary donations, it's also donations of non-perishable foods this particular
It week. Is both. Mm-hmm. We need food contributions and we have a goal to actually
What's that?
Collect. We actually have a goal to collect 10,000 pounds of food this year. And we need the financial contributions to help support the food insecurity initiatives that we have at the Y.
Races are downtown and on the North Shore. They include a 5K, a 1 mile fun run, a 5 mile. So who's participating? Are these families, casual runners, serious runners?
It's everybody. there are the serious runners, the ones who, you know, when I've run it in the past, I'm just starting over the Roberto Clemente Bridge, and then the front of the pack is heading home. you know, so I wave as they go by. And then there are families, there are dogs, there are children in strollers. We have a couple of wheelchair races. everybody. But I think more than anything, it is a family event. We actually have one family who their family members come in from all across the country, and right now there are over 20 of them registered.
So they're not just from Pittsburgh?
No, they're from everywhere. We even have a couple of international runners.
Do you find out about this, and do you have a favorite story about that?
I especially love the families that I see all dressed up. I've seen them, they dress as the entire turkey dinner. I've seen families where they have the knife, the fork, and the plate. And I especially love to see the dogs running, and they usually come in some sort of costume. So it's a lot of fun.
Is there room on the sidelines for non-runners to cheer on the participants?
Absolutely. At any of the races, the 5K, the 5 mile, the one mile, and then there's also the double gobble. That's for the real serious runners.
That's the 5K and the 5 mile?
That is indeed.
Will you be lacing up your own shoes this time?
I will be lacing them up, but I'll be running around at the start line and the finish line and working everything behind the scenes. But it's a wonderful day.
Do you think we as Pittsburghers understand just how widespread food insecurity is in our own city, our own region?
I think we understand the concept of food insecurity, but I don't think all of us understand how widespread it is. That's a really good point. I mean, we talk about Pittsburgh being a wonderful place to live, and it is, but there are pockets of the city where the struggle for food is still very, very real.
Fundraising efforts are often successful around the holidays. People are in that generous mood. How can our community be more consistent in addressing food insecurity year-round?
Well, we welcome everybody's support throughout the year. This is our largest fundraiser, and we take the proceeds from this to help support all of those initiatives throughout the year, but we are always looking for support, and anybody who feels so inclined can reach out and actually get information on volunteering or how to make a gift at our website, which is ymcapgh.org.
Where can runners, spectators drop off donations?
They can drop them off at either Packet Pickup, which runs until 7 p.m. on Wednesday right at PNC Park. And they can bring their food donations on the day of the race as well.
And if they want to run, do they still have time to?
If they want to run, they have to hustle. They can either pre-register online. They can come down to Packet Pickup and register until 7 p.m. on Wednesday. And on the day of the race, we will take some sort of on-the-spot registrations of about 100 people, and that's it.
Carolyn Grady is the Senior Vice President of Development for the YMCA. It's putting on the annual Turkey Trot this Thursday. That's Thanksgiving morning. The first race begins at 8 a.m. on the North Shore. Carolyn, thanks for stopping by.
Thank you, Kevin. Happy Thanksgiving.
Thanks, Carolyn, and to you as well. I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
Economic uncertainty, politics, and a late Thanksgiving could put a damper on the upcoming holiday shopping season. I'm Maria Scapoletto with the Pittsburgh Business Report on 90.5 WESA. The National Retail Federation says holiday sales this season will grow between 3.8% and 4.2%. That's up slightly compared to average holiday sales increases of about 3.7% over the previous 5 years. I asked Dr. Nicole Coleman, an associate professor of marketing at the University of Pittsburgh, for her forecast.
My concern is that while our economic indicators are moderate, consumer sentiment, there's a lot of concerns about uncertainty in the broader geopolitical space, as well as the tariffs that are getting rolled out. There's a bunch of tariffs that are set to hit on December 15th. And while retailers are trying to do some things to ameliorate concerns about those tariffs, they're on items that people could potentially be purchasing for gifts. And so that broader uncertainty and concern about spending in general, I think, is going to temper consumer sentiment and consumer spending. And so I would expect to see an increase because things are solid. There are good fundamentals, but probably in the maybe 2 to 3% range rather than the 5 to 7% that we're seeing in some forecasts.
Anything else give you pause, especially regarding what's happening in the nation's capital?
Well, that's a big source of the uncertainty for consumers right now, is the ability to make predictions about your paycheck and where various things are going over the course of the next year. We have a major election, questions about the impeachment process, and just general things that are happening more broadly in the nation, I think are big distractions for consumers. We would like this time of the year to be one full of joy and excitement and celebrations, but it's hard to feel that way when there's so much sort of fraught emotions out there as well. Yes.
So this isn't just about consumers having the money to spend, it's about their sentiment as well.
Absolutely. And I think what we see is these concerns, sort of political concerns, they kind of put a pall on the joyfulness of the holiday season. And that's compounded by the fact that we have a very short holiday season. There's only 26 days between Thanksgiving and Christmas. Shaw, that's so scary. And that's the shortest it could possibly be, actually. And so we don't have as much time to really get in the spirit, so to speak. And then there are these big things sort of looming over us as well.
Do community events, local community events, help to boost the shopping experience for retailers? And I'm thinking specifically of the Christmas market in Market Square or the Cookie Walk in Lawrenceville. Does that really help?
Absolutely. The wonderful thing about these community events is that they get shoppers out and coming into those brick and mortar spaces, or, you know, the beautiful stalls that are all set up around Market Square during the Christmas market. They get shoppers in the spirit, that joyful spirit around celebration and thinking of others. And they allow that personal connection between the local retailer and the shopper. So those two things together really start to build that connection to encourage shoppers to shift some of their purchasing to those local retailers.
Dr. Nicole Coleman from the University of Pittsburgh speaking with me about the retail holiday shopping forecast. In Pittsburgh Business Headlines, the Community College of Allegheny County last week launched a $65 million workforce development campaign. It's called Pioneering Pittsburgh's New Workforce. The aim is to increase access to programs that prepare students for high-demand careers in fields like cybersecurity, machine learning, and advanced manufacturing and robotics. And the Sony film It's a Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood about Fred Rogers earned $13.5 million at the box office in its opening weekend. By comparison, the documentary about Mr. Rogers released last year called Won't You Be My Neighbor has grossed $23 million to date. I'm Maria Scapoletto with the Pittsburgh Business Report on 90.5 WESA.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Pennsylvania lawmakers on both sides of the aisle have joined to reform the state's criminal justice system. Some measures seek to make it easier for people with criminal records to get hired, while others aim to loosen rules around probation. Republican State Senator Camara Bartolotta has emerged as a leader in the effort, and she spoke with 90.5 WESA's Ann Lee Herring.
You've become a leading voice on criminal justice reform in Pennsylvania since you were elected in 2014. You co-founded the Bipartisan Criminal Justice Reform Caucus, and you've had a leading role in proposing certain reforms at the state capitol. Right. Did you expect when you first came into office that this would be a cause that you would be championing?
No, certainly not when I was first elected in 2014. But over the last several years, and everybody is very familiar with this, I happen to be engaged to the former Speaker of the House, Bill DeWeese, who was incarcerated for 23 months. And he experienced so many different levels of the system and shared with me so much of it and got me involved with and on the board of the Pennsylvania Prison Society, which is incredible. Then just getting to know some of the barriers that the Commonwealth puts in front of people who are trying to do the right thing, trying to regain their lives, trying to take care of their kids and stay out of the system, it's almost as though we're trying really hard to keep them going back. So there's a long, long list of things we need to address to reverse the horrible tide that we caused in the 90s. Well, actually the 80s and the 90s, where it was lock them up, throw away the key, mandatory minimums, tough on crime, and our incarceration rate since the 80s has increased by about 400%. That's a problem. That's not helping anyone.
Would you say that your thinking had really changed on this, or is it something that you just hadn't really prioritized or thought much about?
Well, like a lot of people who aren't exposed or maybe don't have a family member or someone that they know who has been involved in the criminal justice system, I wasn't that familiar with a lot of things, but then I started to understand incarceration is the new cancer. If it hasn't affected you directly, it probably has affected someone that you know. So it's become so prevalent and so pervasive, especially with the opioid epidemic that in Pennsylvania we've experienced over the last 10-year period of time. Everyone seems to be involved with someone who's experienced incarceration or probation and has an issue with the way that we're doing things in Pennsylvania.
So efforts at reform have gotten some traction here in Pennsylvania.
A ton of traction, a ton of attention on the national level. My bill that I'm working on with Senator Anthony Williams, Senate Bill 14, deals with probation reform. So if you're not in the state system and you're just in the county system, well, there are a lot of people who are offered probation in lieu of, or maybe half their sentence could be served in probation. Our problem in Pennsylvania is that we are incarcerating more people for technical violations of probation than for original crimes. Hundreds of millions of dollars putting people behind bars who, I don't know, forgot to call their probation officer, maybe traveled across the county line to take their kids to a soccer game. We're really destroying lives when we could be doing much better.
State Senator Kiamra Bartolotta, thank you.
Thank you so much.
That was WESA's Unley Herring speaking with Kiamra Bartolotta, who represents all or part of Beaver, Greene, and Washington counties. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. A miniature train around a Christmas tree is a tradition for many families at this time of year, but you'd need a whole grove of evergreens for the miniature train display at the Carnegie Science Center. Patty Everly is the curator of historic displays at the Science Center. I spoke to her at the center last week, just as the display reopened for the holidays and its centennial celebration.
The fact that something like this has existed since 1919 is amazing, and that visitors keep coming and they keep growing in number. People associate us with the holiday season, of course, and this is always when we do our work in late fall, add the new piece, and then surprise everybody with it in time for Thanksgiving and the holiday season. But we're here all year round. We are going into our 100th anniversary season. So we will be here for visitors to see at Carnegie Science Center until, again, we close for that short period of time to clean, repair, and add another new feature next fall.
It is a tradition, but it seems like it's handed down generation to generation in families as well.
It is. We love hearing stories, and we hear them every day of, you know, someone whose grandfather brought them to the Buell Planetarium to see it, and now they're bringing their grandchildren to see it and sharing all of their memories. That's the thing that's so special about this display, is it evokes so many memories in people. Maybe things they hadn't thought about in years. Grandfather who worked at the steel mill, or a particular baseball game at Forbes Field. I always say we learn as much from our visitors as they learn from us.
We're standing beside the display right now. For those who haven't seen it, what does it look like to you?
Oh boy, to me it's a giant three-dimensional painting. That's how I've always thought of it, and when I'm working on it, that's how I'm thinking of it. So we pay a great deal of attention to detail, shadows and depth and texture, and visually how the display is going to look. So any new piece has to kind of fit in whatever area it's going to go. The display itself visually is 83 by 30 feet, so it's big. It's not the biggest. We have been told, though, that it is the most detailed. And, of course, we represent southwestern Pennsylvania in everything that we do. So a new piece or anything that we add has to be historically significant, architecturally significant, or culturally significant to this region. And then sometimes they hit all three.
It fills the whole room on this second floor.
It fills our gallery. This gallery was designed specifically for it when we moved in this space in 1992 after being at the Buell Planetarium from 1954.
The story of the display starts with Charles Bowdish. Tell us a bit about his story.
Sure. Well, I took us back to 1954 when it came to the Buell Planetarium. But prior to that, it was founded by a man named Charles Bowdish in his home in Brookville, Pennsylvania in 1919. So that's when he first started to display his craftsmanship with models of Main Street in Brookville and a train. And it was in to entertain the guests at his brother's Christmas Eve wedding. One of the guests wanted to bring some folks over to see it. He thought it was pretty amazing, and 600 people came the first time. Word of it grew nationwide, and he kept a map with pushpins from where everyone come, and he logged 45 states. He had school groups visiting like we do today. We have old photographs of school buses parked in front of his house. It was truly a seasonal display then. At the same time, the Buell was looking to expand on a small holiday display that they had been putting up. And it was kind of kismet that the Buell Planetarium and Charles Bowdish got together and he gave the display to the Buell, but continued to be kind of the artistic director up until his death.
But it already had built a strong fandom, if you would, absolutely, before it coming to the Buell.
Absolutely. We have a lot of photographs of the line outside of Buell snaking around and up the street for blocks. And people would wait. It was part of the tradition of seeing the miniature railroad and village. You'd wait and wait in the line. And then at the Buell, you sort of had this grand overview when you stepped into the gallery.
And you mark his contribution in the display itself. Right, it's represented here. We see a two-story home. We see a workshop, and it was on the second floor. So how do you make it as representative as it should be?
Well, we worked from photographs for Charlie's house. It doesn't exist anymore, but we had quite a few photographs. For other models that we do, a great deal of research goes into them. And if blueprints exist, like the city gave us or the county gave us, the Allegheny County Morgue blueprints, copies to work from, historic photographs, if there are archives that we can research. So this is Charlie's house. We worked from photographs. And you can see we have a line depicted here in miniature. But this is where everyone came from.
I see people waiting to get into the second floor. I see people on the steps waiting to see
right,
the display.
Exactly.
The display itself is full of homages to Pittsburgh's past. What are some of your favorite pieces?
Oh, I've got tons of favorites, obvious. Well, Forbes Field, okay. Definitely. Forbes Field was one of the most requested models our visitors wanted us to add over the years. We had a couple of challenges with the piece. It's big, for one thing, and we couldn't figure out how we would do the fans in the stands. We ended up using 23,000 hand-painted Q-tips.
To represent 23,000 fans?
Exactly. Exactly. Other pieces, Isley's from Cannonsburg. Who doesn't remember an Isley's storefront and going and getting chip-chopped ham and skyscraper cones?
And new this year, the Kaufman's Department Store.
Yes.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin at the Carnegie Science Center with Patty Everly talking about the miniature railroad and village. It's celebrating its 100th birthday this holiday season. Patty, it used to be, as I recall, a holiday display only, open around Thanksgiving to into the new year. When did this diorama of life in Western Pennsylvania become really a year-long exhibit?
Yes, at the Buell Planetarium, the first month it was, first time it was there in 1954, it was only open a month. And tens of thousands of visitors came to see it. So it grew, the duration of its time open grew into late spring. The only reason that they needed to take it down was they needed that space for the science fair. But when the Science Center was built, this gallery was designed for the miniature railroad and village, and that's when it became something that's open year-round except for the period in the fall where we work on it and add a new addition.
Well, speaking of new additions, every year there is a new historic installation. A few years ago was Permane Brothers in the Strip District. Last year it was Cement City, a neighborhood in Denora. Let's take a closer look at this year's edition, Kaufman's Department Store. For our younger listeners and maybe some non-natives, the store actually started in the South Side, but this model is actually a replica of the first version of the downtown store?
It's the first version of the downtown store, which is super cool. It allowed us to go back to the beginning of the story. What is the history of the clock? What's the story behind the clock? Who were the Kaufmans? And this was the very first store that they built on 5th and Smithfield Street downtown, where the building is still stands today. But this building, this version of the building, was demolished in 1912. You can see it's quite ornate. And so that's sort of what set it apart from what they replaced it with, which was much bigger, much taller, but not nearly as ornate. And they eventually grew to open this mega store, which was really glorious shopping for its time.
What are we hearing now?
Now you're hearing the Crawford Grill. That there's a jazz band playing at the Crawford Grill here. So it's playing. They're open 24 hours a day on the Miniature Railroad.
Crawford Grill, the jazz mecca for decades and decades.
Anybody that was anybody played at the Crawford Grill.
You mentioned the clock. There is so much attention to detail. There is the Kaufman's clock right there. People used to come and meet if they're going shopping or working. I'll meet you under the Kaufman's clock.
Right. Now, the story of the clock is probably not what people expect. You'll see this clock is a freestanding clock on the corner, right where the current clock is today, but it was freestanding on the sidewalk. It is where Meet Me Under the Kaufman's Clock all got started. When this building was demolished, the clock went away. And people were in an uproar after a while. Where's our clock? What'd you do with the clock? And the clock that's on the building today is the one that they replaced it with.
What's neat, I think, about the scenes, they aren't just miniature buildings and figurines. They feature a lot of animations. The whole exhibit is meant to display life in Western Pennsylvania, in our region. But the animations, that's what really brings it to life, don't they?
We have over 100 animations, everything from men with sledgehammers at the limestone quarry, hot air balloons, of course, the amusement park. There's men fishing and ladies fishing, and it does bring it to life. It animates the miniature railroad.
And I'm right next to the hot air balloon just rising to the sky right now. Do you like to eavesdrop when school children and families visit and hear and see what they're saying, how they're reacting?
Absolutely. We do that all the time. That's one of the fun things, is to kind of take in, you know, what are they experiencing? And it helps inform us too.
Any favorite memories, any favorite anecdotes you've learned from that sort of listening on in?
Well, what's really cool is you'll have a grandfather who's standing with his family and grandkids at Forbes Field pointing to exactly where he sat when Mazeroski hit his home run in 1960.
So what's this like to you? When the new display, the new season opens up, what are you feeling?
Oh, it's super exciting. You know, we've been working on it since the beginning of October, cleaning it. Every tree gets washed, making repairs to it, refurbishing, landscaping, and the scenic effects that you see. And, of course, building the model and adding it, problem solving all the way. And so, you're tired. You're excited, you're happy about the work and what you've produced, and then you get to see people enjoying it and invite them in. And then, of course, we're always just amazed and grateful and proud that they come.
Patty Everly is the curator of historic exhibits at Carnegie Science Center. Thanks so much for showing us the miniature railroad and village.
Well, thank you for having us. I appreciate it.
You've heard that old saying, it takes a village. Well, for many of us, it takes a miniature railroad and village at the Carnegie Science Center to make it Christmas in Pittsburgh. And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time, as many as 10 million American women suffer from an eating disorder. Are the diagnosis and treatment different for women of middle age? Plus, what will it take to replicate best practices from one city school into another to make a difference in achievement and attendance? If you missed anything from today's program or you'd like to catch up on past shows, please visit wesa.fm/confluence or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.